Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast. My name is T.R.P. Watson, and this time I'm joined by Paul in London, Johnny Fox and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about Billy Bishop Goes to War at the German Street Theatre. This is part of their Rebels season. Billy Bishop Goes to War is a play by John Gray and Eric Peterson. It's directed here by Jimmy Waters, who is Artistic Director of Proud Haddock, which recently gave us Square Rounds at the Finra Theatre. The play is about a young man from Canada called Billy Bishop. He signs up to fight in the war, and it seems to be a conversation with his older self. This play is one of the most performed plays in Canadian theatre. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
It was interesting to see this play because actually I've caught it on the centennial anniversary week of the First World War. And unlike other war stories that are doing the rounds, I understand there's a World War I play at the Union, War Horses back at the National Theatre. This is more about the unlikeliest of heroes, actually. There's sort of this Canadian layabout, William Bishop, known as Billy Bishop, who ends up becoming a star pilot and legend of the Great War. And this production is kind of a two-hander musical by John McLaughlin Gray, a Canadian writer, and it was first performed in the early 80s. And what it's really, it starts out as very much a conversational style, as the older Billy, played quite nicely by Oliver Beamish, who also serves as the music director, playing the piano as well. It's reflecting back on his triumphs and trials during the First World War. And then it switches over to Charles Aitken playing the young Billy, narrating his adventures from almost getting thrown out of military school, but thankfully war was declared, and then finding his way on a boat across the Atlantic to the front and being very quite quickly disillusioned by life in the trenches and wanting to actually do something more adventurous, but also, I think, worthy of what he thought he could do. And so he ends up almost falling into the Air Force, which was just newly formed, and finding his way. And through a series of unusual connections and a bit of luck, he manages to climb the ranks and become, you know, this ace fighter pilot leading up to this very daring raid on a German airbase. Now, part of, I think, though, what's fascinating about this is how the two performers actually just tell this story. And, you know, you just get completely captured by it because it becomes not just the outsider who've made good, the boy who grows up and becomes a man during the war. It's all those things, but it's also actually layered upon, you know, the history of the war, what we think we know of the Boer War, and actually the harsh realities as well. So there's quite a lot going on. And I think what makes this piece work so well is, you know, these two central performers, because these two actors play a range of characters and they do this quite effortlessly. And it becomes just this fascinating piece of storytelling and insight, I think, to the war that you may not necessarily get. It's not particularly sentimental either, which actually I think helps, perhaps, although with the exception of the music, which I didn't think suited the period, nor was it particularly well written. But putting that aside, I think, you know, the performances by the two actors and a wonderful set designed by Daisy Blower just transforms this piece into a series of memories, and pieces from the set suddenly become fighter planes or elegant London homes or grand ballrooms and things like that. So actually, I think it's quite well done in that respect. I think Charles Aitken, who plays the young Billy, has also done a bit of television. So he's got a bit of a following through various shows, including those on Netflix. So it's quite impressive to see him as a performer up close and personal, because he runs about the space of the German Street Theatre. And he's so energetic and enthusiastic as the young Billy. And then when the horror comes in too, it's contrasted nicely. I think all in all, this is one of those great little shows that the space of the German Street Theatre, you know, was perfectly suited for it. But it's just a wonderful looking production with two top performances. Well worth seeing. John, what did you think of it?
I'm fascinated that this is one of the most performed plays in Canada. And Canada really needs to get out a bit more. But I have to say, it is an absolute pleasure to hear an untold story in the theatre, to find a little piece of history that you simply didn't know about. And that was the most interesting thing for me about Billy Bishop Goes to War, that I had no awareness of who this guy was or why he had become such a hero, both to the Canadian forces and to the British. And I recommend that if anybody is thinking of going to this, assuming that broadcast goes out before the end of the run, don't Google him, because really the middle and both ends of this production is telling his fairly straightforward story quite simply, with a lot of charm, and it's a curious story as well, but I'm glad that I had not Googled it before I went to see it. So I think that the things to add to what Paul said are, it's a wonderful set. One of the best I've ever seen in Jermyn Street, a really convincingly decorated bunker designed in meticulous detail by Daisy Blower. I thought every time they picked up a prop or wore another item of clothing, I thought, gosh, you know, how hard has she worked to find these absolutely period perfect items? Somebody has raided an awful lot of attics and junk shops to get all of that. I think I was a little bit resistant to the idea of this being a two-hander, if I'm honest. I always like plays that are populated by more actors, apart from the fact it gives more actors more work. It gives audiences a little bit more to see and to think about. And I wondered whether this production would broaden out successfully onto a bigger stage and with more characters. I think there's more to explore with the character of Lady St. Helier. The guys in the piece are performing her really as if she were sort of Dame Hilda Brackett. It's a caricature like that. But having Googled her, Mary St. Helier is a very interesting character. And, you know, not only was she a chum of Churchill, she knew everybody in the War Office and the Cabinet and was a political activist. I would say mostly behind the scenes, as women in the 1890s and before the First World War tended to be. You know, the thing that really... I am enthusiastic about this piece. I did enjoy it, and I agree with most of what Paul said about it. But if anything lets the side down, it's the music. There were a couple of songs, I think, which genuinely belonged to the period. But a lot more of the music was, I won't say parody, but it was definitely pastiche. And you know, even though Charles Aitken has decent vocals and Oliver Beamish has a lovely sense, a lovely touch on the piano, really, really gorgeous to listen to. But the songs are a bit twee, and they're not, I don't think they're quite right, even as pastiches of the period. I kept, on the way home, I was humming Tom Lehrer's So Long Mum, I'm Off to Drop the Bomb, which was written in the 60s, I think. And I really could hear a lot of that recurring in the melody that gets repeated through the piece. And Aitken sings a very moving tribute to Britain's leading flying ace, a chap called Albert Ball, who had got 44 hits, I think, by the time he died at the age of only 20. And the rhythm is patterned on that 1911 music hall standard, The Green Eye of a Little Yellow God. I'm not going to recite it, but look that up if you need to. I mean, what's to say? You know, Jimmy Walter's direction does keep up the pace and the energy and makes the most of this extraordinary all-purpose set. I thought the dialogue was refreshingly naturalistic, and particularly for a piece that is rooted in the First World War, there's no jingoism, there's no nationalism, there's no false bravado. And this history of the Empire servicemen who came to fight for Britain without really knowing why, I think is simply and sensitively told, and I think it needs to be told. So I think it's a very worthwhile piece.
We're now going to talk about Soldier On at the Other Palace. This is inspired by stories that writer and director Jonathan Lewis workshopped with British soldiers, men and women, and their families over a five-year period. It's just returning to London after a sold-out national tour to commemorate the end of the First World War. John, can you tell me more about this play and what you thought of it?
There is so much good in this that it's almost overwhelming. First of all, I have to tell you about the Soldiers' Arts Academy, which is a charity that helps rehabilitate ex-service people through an active involvement with the theatre. It's run by Amanda Faber, who is a producer and director based in Derby. But she's obviously involved some pretty high-profile actor mates who are either performers alongside the soldiers in this kind of production or who work as tutors and mentors inside the Soldiers Arts Academy charity. So this is a script, as you say, Tim, written by Jonathan Guy Lewis, who is himself ex-army. Actually, he left the army under a bit of a cloud, but he's also been in Soldier Soldier on television. And he starts with a very simple premise, with a sort of a chorus line situation where in a church hall, there are some shonky auditions for a community play based on military lives. And you start with a lot of amateur theatrical banter. But the company really, really hits its stride, vividly depicting those frictions between absent or returned and traumatized soldiers and their families. Some of those scenes really are perfectly observed and quite explosive. Some people who have reviewed this have said, oh, it's impossible to see where the actors leave off and the soldiers begin. I don't think that's true. I think you can spot, or maybe just, you know, because people like us tend to go to the theatre quite a lot, we can spot actors because we recognise them. And there's one chap called Robert Portal, who, if you've seen any kind of BBC historical costume drama that involves a war of any kind, from the sort of Indian Mutiny to the Second World War, you'll have seen him in uniform. He is a ramrod straight actor whose stiffened spine has won him countless soldierly roles. And a very interesting man as well. He's a really gung-ho adventurer who has, been, I don't know, riding or sailing around the world with a lot of bravado. And he plays an ex-colonel, a man brought down by prostate cancer, as well as his military injuries. And it's really interesting to watch him fight this noble battle with his own internal plumbing, and how he needs to control himself when he's asked to give the eulogy at a comrade's funeral and finds he can't, and how that is managed by him and by somebody else at the same event. It's very real, it's very believable, it's very powerfully done. I think it's really tremendous. And then over the other side, you have people who are playing for comedy and, you know, making light of things which have been very, very serious for them. And through that, the performance that you most warm to is a chap called Cassidy Little. I think he might be originally Canadian, but he became a medic in the Royal Marines for our forces and an amputee since an IED incident in Afghanistan in 2011. So he's a very ebullient, cheeky chappy, and, you know, he's showing off his prosthetic leg very openly and amusingly. But he's not only been through the Soldiers Arts Academy, but he's parlayed both his injuries and his natural comic and acting ability into a role in Coronation Street. He's got 6 episodes where he's being a motivational Paralympic athlete who comes to coach and counsel one of the regular members of the Coronation Street cast. So I thought this was really good, really free of mawkishness, except perhaps that there's a sung anthem at the end, and that they have the Military Wives Choir there as a sort of post-curtain extra. And I could have done without that. It was a little bit too syrupy, and I was pushing it a bit too hard to be a Christmas single or something like that. But the other thing you should say about it is that whilst it really gives a genuine warts and all portrayal of what life is like for soldiers who come back from conflict, it's completely free of any discussion about whether they resent the circumstances in which they were injured or the politics which led to their being sent to fight in places so far from home. And I wondered, perhaps there is another piece to be developed by the company about something like this. So I really recommended it, even though it's a little bit weird. You know, we have in the West End the comedy about a bank robbery, and here comes the comedy about post-traumatic stress disorder. But it really was very well done, and there was a great atmosphere inside the theatre, people willing this to succeed. It really was very good, and of course the other great news is James Blunt does not appear in it.
We're now going to talk about Company at the Gielgud Theatre. This is Stephen Sondheim's musical. He wrote the music and lyrics with a book by George Firth. It's directed here by Marion Elliott, with Bunny Christie as the designer and Liam Steele as the choreographer. They have changed something slightly. Company is usually about a 35-year-old young man surrounded by his friends. This time, they have gender-switched quite a lot of the elements. So Bobby is played by Rosalie Craig, And of course, it's a 35-year-old woman. And, well, there are one or two other changes. I believe we have Janie becomes Jamie. And instead of a chorus of Bobby's girlfriends, we get a chorus of Bobby's boyfriends. Rosalie Craig is joined by Patti LuPone as Joanne, and with Mel Giedroyc, Jonathan Bailey, George Blagden, Ashley Campbell, Richard Fleischman, Alex Gaumond, Richard Henders, Ben Lewis, Daisy Maywood, Jennifer Sayang, Matthew Seaton-Young, and Gavin Spokes. They have gender-switched and produced something which I think, certainly on the night I went, everybody was extremely happy with. Phil, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
When it was first announced, I was a bit sort of indifferent towards it. I thought, oh, yeah, another gender-swapping kind of thing. Do we really need this? Excited, even though Patti LuPone was coming over to do it, to play Joanna, which is, has the iconic sort of Ladies' Lunch song made famous by Elaine Stritch. And when you've seen Elaine Stritch do it, which I have, you kind of think nobody can do it as well as that. But when it sort of began to get closer, I did sort of think, oh, maybe I should see that. And actually, all my misgivings were completely dashed. I think Marianne Elliott's reinvention has got sort of just a little touch of genius about it. And I feel it sort of makes complete sense to have a woman playing Bobby, because there's different issues at stake with getting to 35 and not being in a relationship, much more urgent issues, perhaps. And that adds a certain something to it, because I thought, oh, they're doing it because it's to give a woman a leading role in a musical rather than man again. But actually, in terms of that, it means that several more characters are switched the other way from female to male. So in terms of giving actresses work, it doesn't work at all like that. So I think that what it adds to it is to just, you just sort of see it afresh. I've always found Company a really enjoyable show with a lot of great numbers, but it sort of feels like a sum of parts. I mean, parts of Follies can feel a bit like that. But I thought this was much more complete. It's still sort of a series of numbers, and all the friends of Bobby, who was Bobby with a Y, now Bobby with an IE on the end, sort of have their moment, and they're all there to point out why being in a relationship is much better than being single, and then contradict themselves in the process. There's some great set pieces in it. I think that Mel Giedroyc and Gavin Spokes are excellent in a very early scene where she's trying not to eat and they're also demonstrating jiu-jitsu. It's a very, very funny scene. The kind of standout number during the show is Jonathan Bailey, who, instead of being a woman getting cold feet on a wedding day, is now about to marry in a gay relationship, in a gay male relationship, obviously, and has the breakneck speed number of getting married today, which is sort of the comedy highlight of the show. Even if some of the words you couldn't quite pick out, I've never actually seen a version of this where you can actually grab every word, and it's absolutely hilarious, and, you know, kind of does pretty much stop the show. I think Richard Fleischman, who gets the Barcelona number, is really, really very funny. I've seen him in quite a lot of shows and never really realised how funny he could be. It's really showing people off to their best advantage. Patti LuPone at first, I thought, particularly in the first act, of the people in the things, actually seemed to have the weakest voice, rather bizarrely. But she sort of comes into her own when she gets the Ladies Who Lunch number towards the end, and is just one of many great numbers. There's a couple of numbers that I didn't think work as well as they could have done. I was slightly disappointed with Rosalie Craig, who I thought was very good in this. Her being alive didn't quite fully work for me, but that's kind of being really nitpicky. Also on top of this, I thought the design of it was absolutely stunning. Bunny Christie sets, like a series of rooms, which have sort of little Alice in Wonderland touch to them. They're sort of edged with neon, and they're very, very stylish. There's some nice, witty touches amongst them. It never looks less than lovely to look at. One of the things that actually I've forgotten about is the fact how funny the whole show is. It's really, really very funny. I mean, we immediately after seeing it, we started discussing booking to see it again, and we have now booked again to see it before the reviews came out, and that's about as high praise as I can give to anything. I really have very few, a few minor quibbles about it, but there's always going to be that. How about you, Tim?
Well, as you know, I'm not an expert on musicals, but I have seen this one before, and I was a little bit worried that it was being a bit too funny. They were putting a bit too much comedy in it, and all the Sondheim aficionados would just say, no, it's got to be much more serious and much more heartbreaking than this. But it's enormous fun throughout. I think I was sitting next to an actress who had actually played Janie, who's Jamie in this, played by Jonathan Bailey. She was tapping out every word that Jonathan Bailey was singing, almost as if she was saying, yes, you get that one and that one and that one and that one and that one in the patter song. She was obviously completely in love with it. I don't know what the fuss is about Patti LuPone as a, not a musical person. So when she got a standing ovation for Ladies Who Lunch from pretty much everybody, I was a little bit nonplussed, because as you say, I mean, I have heard Elaine Stritch singing it, not live, but recordings and television things, and know how well she does it. And I've always been, and you know, she is somebody, I know what the fuss is about Elaine Stritch, but I didn't quite get it as much. I mean, it was certainly very well done, but I think everybody is, with that particular song, everybody is singing at the altar of Elaine Stritch, and you're never going to be as good or as impressive as her. But I thought she was very good. I found it delightful, and frankly, if somebody said they have a spare ticket, do I want to come again, I probably would. It was extremely good fun, and we had a great time. This is really well thought out, and like you said, the way that they've changed it to being a woman, you sit there and think, well, why was it ever about a man? You know, why did they bother? Because Rosalie Craig fits into this so well. I mean, it should be said that she has been off during the previews, and Jennifer Tseng has taken over, and people have said it works pretty much just as well with her in the part. So it is something that they've remade it and recrafted the play so that it suits a woman almost as well as it ever suited a man. And I think that that's something, you know, quite remarkable about this production. And perhaps we may never see Bobby done as a boy anymore, which could be quite interesting.
So, yeah, we'll definitely be seeing it done with a woman again quite a lot in the future. And I'm sure this production's going to head to Broadway in some shape or form, certainly with Patti LuPone, if she can bring herself to do it, because I thought she'd given up doing musicals. But anyway, there you go. I mean, and it's quite an easy part for her, really. She doesn't have to do an awful lot. She shifts a bit of furniture around earlier on, but, and then the big number towards the end, and then gets a standing ovation, although not on the night I saw it. She got one for the curtain call, but not during the actual show, thank God.
Well, first of all, I think the thing to say is we're all largely of the same mind. It is an extraordinary piece of production, technically, and a chunky investment as well. But I am entirely in agreement with Phil that what this has done is re-established Company as a new format with a female protagonist. I think this is the way it will be staged henceforward, because it will have given it another 40-year life, because it just contains so much more relevance and freshness. And I think what Marianne Elliott and her team have done is to completely re-energize and modernize what was already a pretty cutting-edge musical. It's always been considered to be progressive when it first came out in, is it 1970? And to redefine it like this and to work it so craftily is, I think, a piece of genius that just builds on her tremendous reputation with War Horse and Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. She really is a woman for the ages. All praise to her. I went to see Company on the kind of gala night. So the audience was absolutely rammed with friends and family of the cast, and most importantly, the money. That's the visiting investors from the United States and Canada who are here to see how the producers spent their initial investment, which is rumoured to be 3 million quid. So it was a hugely enthusiastic house, which greeted every scene and every song with an absolute roar of approval. Most of which is richly deserved, of course, but it just may be interesting to pop back to a midweek matinee in February when Follies has also opened again at the National Theatre, so you could really overdose with a magnum of vintage Sondheim on the same day. I'm just speculating about what sort of life the production will have. It looks, from the way it is all set up, as though it is intended to have a transfer to Canada because Mirvish is involved, and to the United States, to Broadway, in some form or other, with or without Patti LuPone, who knows. And I think that's the time it will recoup its investment. I don't think a six-month run at the Gielgud will pay back what it has cost. Anyway, phone rings, door chimes, in comes Watt. I think what comes in is a cast that is very, very long on talent. You know, the casting is good, but it's very short on household names. Rosalie Craig has good credentials for things like The Light Princess at the National Theatre and for Ragtime, but she's not Britain's number one leading lady or anything like that. And of course, she has no television or film profile, which sometimes makes things difficult for putting bums on seats. So the main bum putter is Patti LuPone, Broadway legend, but largely admired and followed by, let's call them the greys and the gays that maintain the West End and keep it afloat. Is she going to bring the coaches from Nottingham and Leeds and Birmingham that really sustain things like Jersey Boys and Kinky Boots and have kept them in such good business for so long? I don't know. Anyway, performances. I think Rosalie Craig is really smart and likable as Bobby. And what that does is to throw into relief the fact that the rest of the characters are absolute bloody nightmares. And you really wonder why she put up with them for so long. And then the whole thing is propelled on this grand scale rolling stock set by Bunny Christie, which I think is very good anyway. And what I liked even more were the sly little references and motifs from Alice in Wonderland, which added a surreal layer for me to Bobby's fears and dreams about marriage and relationships. And I liked that so much. And that really fitted well with her kind of relaxed intelligence and wonderful sardonic detachment with which it's very easy to identify. So she's a good protagonist. You do engage with her. Although I don't think emotionally, I think the thing that Company lacks as a musical is it's a great song cycle. There are some great turns in it, which I'll come to in a minute. But you don't, well, there is no big romance. You don't follow her. You don't really care what happens to her, I think, is possibly true. And then nothing does happen, because the whole thing could be contained within a day, because what actually happens is that Bobby has a birthday, lots of her friends give her advice about saying you're 35, you ought to get married. And that's really where we are at the end of the structure, as the same as we are at the beginning. But I'm really struggling to try and find things to critique about it, because there is no doubt that this will win every Olivier going. It will be hailed as the musical production of the year, in the same way that, you know, nothing will beat The Inheritance in the play category. We've already got our winners for, is it next February? It's quite a long time away. So there are, as I say, two things that set this production apart from others I've seen. First of all, there is more scenery than I've ever seen in a production of Company. Usually it's done as almost like a song cycle, a fluid parade of songs, and the dialogue is a bit secondary, as I say, because it's quite a plotless show. But here, of course, you have lots and lots of apartments and locations realised in this wonderful neon-edged scenery setting. But there's definitely a succession of turns that sort of makes it a little bit uneven, but uneven with more peaks than troughs, and that's obviously what you're aiming for. So you've got Jonathan Bailey playing one of the gender reassigned roles. He is Jamie, who is formerly Amy in the original, and that's a young person, very nervous about getting married. So he's ramped up. He's a hyper-neurotic gay man, and camply and emphatically updates the song Getting Married Today with what I thought was the frantic, jittering energy of a man 2 grams down after dinner. It's undeniably a showstopper. It's also very deliberately at odds with the otherwise very bland niceness of the Jamie character. But he really does punctuate it very well. And it was interesting, Tim, that you said you were sat next to an actress who had played Amy in a previous role and was sort of tapping out the rhythms. I think, did Phil say you didn't quite get all the words? It is an incredibly hard song to do. I've seen Maria Friedman attempt it and have to have 3 goes at it before she finished it. It's a real test of memory. And it takes a musician's capability to fit that to the music. And Jonathan Bailey is an actor who sings. He's not a singer who acts, if you see what I mean. But it brought the house down, obviously. It was very, very enjoyable. And I absolutely loved the celebrant appearing out of the floor and from the fridge. Just a hoot. I like the way Bobby's three lovers, who are now three guys make the most of You Could Drive a Person Crazy. There are some splendid harmonies and a nice, fresh orchestration. And out of the three of them, it really makes you think that it's Richard Fleischman's gauche, dopey, muscular flight attendant, Andy, formerly called June, that you wish she'd choose. Because, again, I keep coming back to the fact that most of the characters are really unpleasant. He is nice. He's dim, but he actually is a nice person. I mean, he might be the only one that she meets in the whole production. But the reworking of Barcelona as a dream sequence is a highlight. That's a clever way to extend it. And Marianne Elliott makes sure that Richard Fleischman goes to the bathroom in a towel three times, just in case you missed out seeing his spray tan and his utter buffness. But I want to praise him because people think of him as, you know, someone who spends a lot of time in the gym, as Phil said, and he's obviously had a musical career, but I think his skill is possibly in comedy. He has very good timing, and I think that his future might well be more in musical comedy than as a recording artist, for example. One of my favourite songs from Company is Another 100 People. It's marvellous. It should be a big ensemble number. You should see millions of people, again, coming out of the floor, crossing the stage, whatever it is. And it's done in a different way here. It's staged rather like the subway chase scene in the musical Ghost. Oh, it was Richard Fleischman again, wasn't it? But the vocals are inexplicably delivered in an Oxford accent, not just a mid-Atlantic, not just an English accent, but a very precise RP by George Blagden. And I thought that made an absolute nonsense of the number, which is all about New York, all about America, all about American attitudes. And I didn't understand why you would have that sung by someone who's pretending to be an Englishman in New York. It's not really a motif that I think Sondheim ever intended to deal with. So inexorably, we move on to the 11 o'clock number featuring Broadway's resident snapping turtle, Patti LuPone. I have to say, I went to the press launch of this and I met and interviewed Patti LuPone, and she is nothing like her public persona. She is absolutely charming and open and funny and really quite lovely. And I fear that she has not been best served by the production. In modernising the show, Marianne Elliott gave all the other characters an opening for more contemporary phrasing in their dialogue and in the way they sing their songs. But the character of Joanne has been kept like a fly in amber, really unreconstructed from the 1970 original. Now, firstly, if I'd been there at Sondheim's house with Marianne Elliott discussing how they changed all the genders, I'd have made a case to make Bobby's favoured older confidant a gay man, because a lot of young women do have gay men as their best friends who steer them through career and relationships and so on. But if it had to be female, I think Patti LuPone should have been permitted to make it more like herself in a way, you know, to use her own perfectly lovely hair instead of the severe bobbed wing, which looks like a Primark version of Cheetah Rivera in Kiss of the Spider Woman, and some softer, more modern clothes. As it is, she seems imprisoned. You know, in all her scenes, she's trapped like Betty Davis in, well, I was going to say Bette Davis in All About Eve, but really Bette Davis in just about anything, just standing three quarters onto the audience and dripping poisonous one-liners. That feels much more dated than everything fresh about the rest of the production. Now, when it comes to the crunch song, I have to admit a bias. Like Phil, I have heard Elaine Stritch deliver this. In fact, I sat at Elaine Stritch's feet just about the last time she sang Here's to the Ladies Who Lunch at the Cafe Carlyle in New York. And it really was unforgettable to hear a song which had defined her and her career for 40 years. But she was never the strongest singer. She was a great interpreter of the song, but I was really looking forward to hear a proper singer, if you like, a singer with Juilliard training, like Patti LuPone, be able to deliver it. And I thought she got the grasp of it early on. She was pacing herself carefully. There were some faltering emotional breaks in the voice, but it was very supported and it was very musical. And then something seemed to happen about two-thirds of the way through, as though there was a gear change, and in a kind, she went on sort of diva autopilot and got all brassy and Broadway and just hammered it into the plaster cherubs on the front of the balcony. And I thought she wasted an opportunity to make it so much more emotional. If you'd seen her do Rose's Turn in Gypsy, she can do that. She can break your heart with a song. And this would have been a real opportunity to do that. It is sometimes hard to remember she was the original vulnerable Fantine in Les Miserables. So it was just a little bit too hard-boiled for me. I'm sorry about that, because I really wanted her to have an even greater tour de force with it. But, you know, the audience loved it. They did, again, they, like Phil said, they didn't stand up until the very end of the show. But, you know, there is subtlety in Company. It's not all full-on turns like those I've just described. I think the number I liked best, because it gave me a new perspective on a song I didn't know quite so well, was Gavin Spokes leading the Husbands in Sorry Grateful, which really explains how you compromise and the habits you form over a long marriage or relationship. And I thought that got closest to a naturalistic and emotional heart in a show that I really don't think has one. But, oh, it's a very good production. You know, you can't deny it. Top price, £99. I don't think it's overpriced either. But it isn't as clever and enveloping as American in Paris. It isn't as gloriously escapist and luxurious as The King and I. So I would be interested to see whether those investors in the middle of the stalls on Wednesday night are going to get their money back. But it really was a night to remember, and it's definitely a show not to miss.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.